Have you ever heard this cliche, you are what you eat? I think that cliche, you are what you eat, can be defended logically. However, it originated when somebody was thinking about chemical additives to food, the nutritional value, caloric content, whether food was synthetic or was it natural, that sort of thing. All of these are physical items, and that's what most people consider when they think in terms of what's important when it comes to eating healthily. Well, I think that cliche may be true up to a certain point, but it's even truer if we were to expand the idea of what it is we mean by eat, and what do we mean by how we eat. Anybody who thinks that a mother's milk is the only deliverable to a nursing baby is mistaken. A lot more than milk is being delivered to that baby and eaten by that baby. Despite all the marketing and all the hype and all the promotional efforts of companies that manufacture baby formula to convince parents and doctors that their chemical solutions made in factories are equal to or even better than mother's milk, research has shown, as well as common sense, that this is an outrageous lie. It's a lie that harms babies, it harms the mothers, it harms families, and it harms society. But it is a lie that is really very good for corporate profits. Above and beyond the enormous value to the baby's immune system that is in the mother's milk, antibodies and other things, the baby takes in, eats, if you will, the mother's emotional vibrations, the energy vibrations during nursing. Adults with some degree of awareness, you know, you've read stuff, you've heard stuff. We know that scientific research is true when it proves that the emotional state of the person eating a meal is directly and dramatically affecting the quality of that meal. That is true of babies, and it is true of adults. Before Masaru Emoto did his work showing the impact of thought, especially emotionalized thought, on water molecules, he took the water and then froze it and then looked under a microscope at it. Before he did that, most people knew, and even tried this out, I'll bet, at home, that you could help or harm a growing plant by the way you talk to it. I know as a kid that my sister Anne, my younger sister, did that. She and my mother practiced that on a plant just to prove a point to themselves, and it proved the point. So if we have that impact on a plant, you can imagine that impact on an infant or a small child or even an older child. If you haven't seen this excellent documentary about water, it's called Water, The Great Mystery. Water-The Great Mystery. If you search on YouTube, you're going to see that there's probably 8 or 9 different segments to that. It is a very, very well done documentary. It interviews a whole bunch of people. There are subtitles in certain cases. But it is important information about what keeps us alive and healthy, or partially alive and sickly. In the development of a child in the womb, the mother magnetically draws to her and the baby-to-be the, quotes, building materials, end quotes, that are going to be used to grow these two bodies, to maintain the mother's body, as well as to assemble that baby's developing body in the womb. That's not too complicated to understand. And so it's this act of drawing the building materials to her and the baby-to-be that the mother's emotional state feeds the baby. Not only does it feed the baby, but it filters what is received by the baby. Only in recent years have doctors noticed that babies can be born depressed. And guess what else that the doctors have noticed? Finally, when a baby is born depressed, it is born depressed to a depressed mother. So the emotional state elevates or contaminates the emotional state of the baby-to-be. Now, here in 2013, we go, wow, this is recent knowledge? We didn't know this before? Well, some people knew it, but scientifically, it was not that important, apparently. If you look around the United States and you can see, what's important here? Weight loss, obesity, and dieting programs. And those things are on the bestseller list year after year after year. And talk on TV is about it all the time. Even talk in conversation is about it. But now, people are starting to put their attention on the emotional state of the person who is sitting down to eat. Previously, and I think this is an important idea too, all the attention was put on the food, its caloric content, maybe its portion size, its nutritional value, its whether it was organic or not, and the way the food was cooked. The emotional state of the person eating has a direct effect on the food and on that person's body, which is going to be the machinery that is going to digest and either use this food or not. We change the vibration of the food from either a higher to a lower value or from a lower to a higher value. And that's one of the points that was made in the Water the Great Mystery when they talk about a particular monk who was imprisoned and considered to be a real, real problem to the establishment. You'll be fascinated by that one little segment based upon what I just said, but that entire documentary is a wake-up call to us. We also can affect our body's digestive functions to make it more able or less able, and the signal we send to it is, here, this is what you should do with this additional energy that I just ingested. When we nurse on an anger-filled breast, and that's the topic today, nursing on an anger-filled breast, we ingest the vibrations of anger. If our mother resented her status, her family situation, the economics, what was going on in her life, even the baby she had to nurse, that baby would be born with and develop a tendency toward anger. If we asked a person that we came across later in life, you know, like tomorrow, a real angry person, we asked this question, why are you so angry? It would be accurate and fair for that person, him or her, to say, because I drank a lot of anger when I was young. That is valid. That's a valid concept. A problem with eating anger as a baby and eating angry when we're adults is that the anger is a signal to the body that we are being threatened. And the body can easily translate that into the fight response. If we're going to go fight something, the body is usually going to interpret that as a need to add more energy, to stockpile the energy, to create a surplus, because during war, there's going to be additional demands for energy, and it pays to have it stockpiled. If a country is preparing to go to war, they start to stockpile stuff. They make planes and bombs and bullets and fuel, and they start stockpiling it. The body does the same thing. And we see it as a factor in putting on weight. Putting on weight that people don't consciously want. No. I'm angry at so-and-so, but I don't want to put on weight. But the subconscious is working to create that extra weight, that extra surplus, that extra energy that presumably would be used in the incoming and oncoming war. If we can receive depression and anger from our mothers, you think we could receive other dominant emotions from her too? That they could be transmitted to us as well? I think so. And if you listen to Bruce Lipton, he was the author of Biology of Belief. He says that up until about the age of 6, children don't have the ability to filter environmental signals. They can't filter it for accuracy or relevance to them or its meaning. Everything said, transmitted, felt, projected, broadcast around them penetrates their subconscious minds as if it were about them and as if it were true. So if a child is exposed to arguments as a little child, they're going to be interpreting this to be about them. that's a problem. So for me to say a child can be traumatized by living in a hostile environment, you go, duh, yeah, that's pretty easy. Parents fighting antagonistic siblings or neighbors, conditions in the family of dire health or financial circumstances, all of that can squash a child's sense of self. That child is trying to assemble an understanding of who they are, what they are, where they are, where they belong in that world, in that family. And the family, of course, up to a certain point, is the world. They are creating their identity at that point. Marianne read me a quote the other day about worry. It was by Charles Spurgeon, and it was this: anxiety does not empty tomorrow of sorrow, but only empties today of its strength. I thought, wow, that's cool. That's cool. So if your mother worried excessively during the pregnancy or soon thereafter, and I know from experience, I've heard people talk about there was a stillborn or a miscarriage of an earlier child, and now that mother is like on pins and needles worrying, uh-oh, I got to be careful, I got to be careful. All of that worry is fed directly to the developing fetus. And if your mother was worried, normal worry, if you're a first child, I think it's pretty safe to assume that your mother is going to be more worried than she would, say, for the second or third or fourth or fifth child if your birth went normally. If your birth was problematic, then I would think she would have practiced worrying. So the second or third or fourth is going, they're going to be pelted, bathed, immersed in the vibration of worry. I think one of the things that a person would do and should do, and I say this to them periodically, people go, I want to analyze my background and find the root cause of the problems that I'm experiencing in life. When should I begin? At birth? I go, nope. Okay. 3 months before birth? Nope. I said, go 3 months before you were conceived. Try to figure out, imagine, if you will, what your father was going through, what your mother was going through, what the condition of your family of origin was 3 months before you were conceived. And then you can look at conception. You can look at your 9 months in utero. You can look at your physical birth. Was it problematic? Was there emergency? Was it difficult? That sort of thing. And then look at your first 6 years when you came home, how you fit into that family dynamic. Were you loved and wanted, or were you the new saber-toothed tiger walking into the den, or literally being carried into the den, into the home? When you start looking at those things, you go like, whoa, there was a lot of energy flying around, not all of it benign, not all of it loving, not all of it benevolent. And guess what? That would have penetrated us. That would have entered into our consciousness. That would still be in our fields. And we have an opportunity now to work on that, heal it, get new points of view to be able to shift all of that. If you look at your childhood and even your time in utero, I believe this to be true. Everyone and everything we interacted with was our teacher. And so if we're inside our mothers at the time, everybody that she is interacting with is our teacher. And we interpret those teachings to be about us, about life, how we belong, whether we're wanted, whether we're loved, whether life is easy, whether life is hard, whether things are disappointing or exciting, what the future is going to be like, and so on. We have a lot of teachers. Our pets taught us about care or about neglect, for example. So if you look back at those childhood experiences, if you had a pet in your family, That pet probably was very loving to you, but was the family loving to it? Our family's finances taught us about prosperity or perhaps poverty. We drew conclusions about ourselves in many areas, right? You say, like, how holy am I? That was a big thing for a lot of us, certainly in my family. You know, we were trying to be good, holy people. We weren't doing too well, but we had that standard. We were trying to be like that. And how good were we? How happy could we be? How respectable were we as people, as a family, as an ethnic group, as a religious group? How smart were we? How good-looking were we? How kind were we? And it goes on and on and on. You learned that. I learned that. Those inputs were given to us. We learned about bedtime, mealtimes, playtimes, work, tidiness or sloppiness. We learned about reading or not reading, willingness to talk about ideas and have rational discussions, or that all of that was impermissible. You couldn't think your own thoughts. You couldn't express your own thoughts. You had to obey somebody else's. Only one person in the family could have a thought for some people. You learned about male-female relationships, husband-wife relationships, sibling, brother-sister relationships, friend relationships. All of these things resulted in a description of how we fit or didn't fit into the world. But here's the real problem with all of this. It's not true. It's not valid, and it's not accurate. Our entire definition of who we are, what life is like, and what we can be and do and have is based largely on input from ineffective people who are malfunctioning physically or emotionally or mentally, financially, and complicated even by our own limited understanding that we had when we were younger. We built our sense of self, our identity that we were going to wear and develop for the rest of our lives on a foundation of lies told to us by others and ourselves, because all of us had limited understanding of life. It's like, yikes, we would never hire a building contractor to build a house. You know how to build a house? No. Okay, you're hired. Do you need a foundation? That sand's okay. That sand is okay. That kind of looks like quicksand. Yeah, that's okay. We could build like that. Yeah, that's not really how we want to do it. We can renovate. That's a good thing. Even if we've nursed on an anger-filled breast, we can renovate our identity. I've often wondered about the tendency to sit down and then beginning to think about things that make me angry. Feel good, sit down, pick up the fork, put some food in my mouth, and then start thinking about things that really irritate me. Like, wow, what happened? Why would eating be associated with anger? Perhaps because of nursing on an anger-filled breast? Maybe. Years ago, I saw a movie, maybe you did too, and if you haven't, you'd want to rent this because it's really, really good. Like Water, Like Chocolate. It won that year the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. And the woman who stars in this, she's the one that does the cooking, without meaning to in certain cases, she is experiencing different emotions as she's preparing food for her family and for guests. And the movie is about how all of this different stuff happens, and it's absolutely fascinating. So as her moods change, the quality of the food and the impact on the people eating the food is dramatized. Very interesting. And frankly, realistic. My mother was a registered nurse. She loved her work. She loved her children, all seven of us. She was also a wife. But my mother didn't love being a housekeeper, and she didn't love being a cook. She didn't enjoy either housekeeping or cooking. She was an intellectual. She appreciated using her mind and her training, and was very well read, and she was interested in healing, not housework or chores. I can It's very easy, and I can imagine that. Feeding 8 people, working full-time, having responsibility for housekeeping, and being angry at her husband, my father, for not doing his share, was, in all likelihood, the condition in the house. I saw it plenty of times, but I'll bet that was standard. And having 7 kids? That was not her idea. It was my father's commitment to his Roman Catholic religion. He thought that was the thing to do to be a good Catholic. Yet, I have no doubt that a lot of anger went into our food on a regular basis. You probably could have scooped it out of the air if we had an appropriate container. Being mindful of the relationship between what we do and our emotional states, though, could help us differentiate between our own feelings from the feelings that were served to us as children. The fact that we might have eaten a meal of anger early on, we'd go, well, yeah, but, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years later, I don't really have to do that any longer. That's true. We can make our own decisions now that there might be a better way. Just because we've habituated that because of training, if you will, of experience, of repetition of a behavior, doesn't mean we can't change at this late date. Knowing these patterns, if you can just be aware of these patterns, it's like, yeah. That's enough to make us aware enough to see other choices of emotions when we sit down. And we can actually go back and heal the original associations of some activity to food. You know, on a regular basis, I mentioned this idea of, to me, ice cream equals good and normal. When my family of origin was like Ozzie and Harriet, we had ice cream on Friday night. Ice cream equals normal, peaceful, happy family. So when I want to feel normal, happy, peaceful, you know, if somebody mentions ice cream, I'm all for it. Let's go. That's what I had for dinner on my birthday this past week. So what do you want for dinner? I want ice cream, period, ice cream. And so once a year, that's what I do. I do a serious amount of ice cream. Not that that's the only time during the year, but it's that association. You know, we say comfort food. This food equals comfort. What is that? Depends on what your experiences are. For some people, it's this. Some people, it's another thing. And people associate a lot of good, even with things that are not good. Cigarettes equal good. You sure? Well, I'm using information that I processed when I was 5. You may want to review that information to see if that's actually valid today. And we can transform any of our activities, including eating, into a sacrament of gratitude and appreciation by knowing divine intention that was in the impulse behind every action before it was influenced, for better or worse, by human consciousness. We can reach deeper in thought and feeling, and we can bypass the distortion that might have occurred to the love that was originally intended. We don't need to eat angry any longer, even if that's the way it was. We don't need to eat sadness or grief. We don't need to eat shame. We don't need to eat pride or fear. We can make changes in the way we process that information. And being aware of it is the first step. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8 of Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you're perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.